good afternoon. A reminder right at the outset, we do not have class next week. It will be Erev Shavuot. I will be napping. No, I won't be napping. But I'll be wishing I were napping. Does that count? But for anyone who's in Thornhill or at B'nai Torah, you are more than welcome to participate in the Shavuot Shirim. Otherwise, see you back here in 2 weeks. I also don't yet know what our end date is. I'm guessing June 20. What do you think about June 20? So that won't happen because there are a lot of people who have going away plans, and I wouldn't want someone to attend Ezra all year long and then miss because they have a summer break. But June 20 is what I'm thinking right now, but I'll have to talk to the powers that be in order to determine this. Okay. We are at the end of Perek Ches, the end of chapter 8. We are on page 1833, if you have a Tanakh. If you don't have a Tanakh, you're going to want one, because we're going to be using it.
What did you say? Did you say 24?
Chapter 8, sentence 35, is page 1833. I may have mentioned other numbers. I mentioned June 20, but that had nothing to do with this. Excellent. You and me both. Yes. Well, that's more feeling Yiddish than speaking. That's a word you only know by emotion. So, Ezra and his crew have come in, right? Yes.
Maybe we start. I'm not going to be crawling the door here before I went away to Florida, and I can't.
Oh.
I wonder if you ever saw it, you picked it up and didn't know who it was.
Has anyone seen a Mikraot Gedolot, Ezra and Nehemiah? Well, Joyce is about to check in the office, so that's always a good place to check, and we'll see what they know. The other possibility would be if it was on a week when we were meeting in the Beit Midrash, it could have ended up on a bookshelf there. So that would be something, someone walks in, doesn't recognize the book, puts it on the shelf. Yeah, so that might also be something to look into. Okay. So Ezra and his crew have now arrived. They are in Israel. They spent their 3 days recuperating from their trip, or 3 days transforming themselves into Israelis. We gave multiple explanations for the 3 day wait. And then they are received at the Beit HaMikdash, at the temple. There's a full accounting of all the items that they brought, and then they bring karbanot, they bring offerings. And what I want to do for our first few minutes today is look a little further at these offerings they brought before we launch into the last part of Ezra, which is chapters 9 and 10. So, we already noted sentences 35 and 36 in chapter 8, in which we were told they brought burnt offerings, olot, for the God of Israel. They brought 12 bulls for the entire nation, we presume one per tribe. They brought 96 rams, which we presume is 8 per tribe. They brought 77 sheep, and we had not a clue why 77. The suggestion was made 77 is a good number in Judaism, 7 is a good number in Judaism, all true. Nonetheless, I don't know why 77. And then we had these 12 tzfirei chatat, these 12 troubling goats. They're listed as chatat, which means a sin offering usually, but we're told that all of this was an olah, was a burnt offering. And so we were trying to figure out what this is, why you're bringing a chatat that you're not planning on eating. And we gave two approaches. One approach was the Rambam's approach. Maimonides says these are a form of miluim. They are dedication offerings for the temple. That's his language. We noted that this is strange, because you bring miluim when you dedicate the temple. The temple was dedicated before Ezra and crew ever showed up. There's no reason why they would be doing miluim. The answer may be, okay, nonetheless, that's exactly what they did. That's what the Rambam seems to think. I don't know if someone's phone or something is that in here?
It's
from outside?
It's the lights.
No, it's not the light. Okay. Okay. Part of the environment. But the other approach is the Gemara's approach regarding the chatat. And the Gemara's approach is decidedly different from that which the Rambam says. If you have the source sheets, the Gemara is on source number 1. Amar Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi said, he quotes our verse. Habayim mehashve may. That's odd. Habayim mehashvi b'nei hagola. That's why Rabbi Yossi skips a word in the Gemara. Doesn't have, it's missing a word in the Gemara. Habayim mehashvi b'nei hagola. Those who came from the exile, those who returned now, hikrivu olal elokei Yisrael. They brought burnt offerings to the God of Israel. Parim 12 bulls. Hakol ola, all burnt offerings. So the Gemara says, I don't understand. Hakol ola. Could they really all be burnt offerings? Exactly what we asked. Efshar shechatat ola? Could a chatat be a burnt offering? You're not supposed to burn it. Ella, rather, hakol ki'ola. Rather, all of them were like burnt offerings. What does that mean? Ma ola lo ne'echelet, av chatat lo ne'echelet. Just like the burnt offering is not eaten, so these chatat offerings were not eaten. But why wouldn't they be eaten? You're supposed to have the Kohen eat part of the sin offering. So the Gemara explains, Disanya, as a brisa says, Rabbi Yehuda, Omer alavodas kochavim heviyum. Rabbi Yehuda says, it's because they brought the Karban Chatat to atone for idolatry, and you don't eat, no one eats from a sin offering if it's brought to atone for idolatry. This is unique. It has different rules. So that's the idea. Except the big question is, of course, whose idolatry are you atoning for? What idolatry? So here we get a very interesting answer. V'amar of Yehuda amar Shmuel ala avodas kochavim sha'asu bimei Tzidkiyahu. It's because of the idolatry that was worshipped in the days of Tzidkiyahu. The days of Tzidkiyahu, he's the last king of the first temple period.
What does it mean? What does that mean?
Tzidkiyahu, Zedekiah maybe.
For those of us who do
that. Yes, I think Zedekiah would be the way it's written.
So
one problem you immediately have is that we have to think that the people who made this journey, you know, maybe there are one or two of them who are from back then. We already noted that one could survive a 70-year period. It's not out of the question. It's even not out of the question for someone to have been of age at the original time of the idolatry. But how many of the people there? You're bringing 77, you know, of these, or even 12 of these offerings for, you know, on their behalf. That's very strange. So the Gemara discusses it. I skipped some of the discussion from the Gemara on the page, but what the answer essentially is that the tzibur, the community, never dies. So if there is a transgression on the record for the community, the later generation is in fact able to come and atone. And we do this all the time in Judaism, both for the negative and for the positive, where we'll talk about the merit of our ancestors and claim it for ourselves. So here too, this is part of the record for the nation. But the Gemara has a different problem. V'hamizidin havu. They knew exactly what they were doing when they worshipped idolatry. They knew that it was wrong. And the general rule is that a sin offering is brought to atone for accidental error. The Mishnah in the second chapter in the volume called Kritut offers a couple of examples, maybe even as many as five examples, where somebody who sins intentionally does bring an offering. But those are unique cases. Generally speaking, you don't bring an offering for intentional sin, not because intentional sin is better than accidental sin, but because you don't qualify for atonement. A person who sins intentionally is not able to say to God, oops, my bad, here's a gift to show how sincere I am, and to atone that way. Susan?
On Yom Kippur, don't we get to atone for the Mezid and Shtetah?
So you are correct. Yom Kippur is different from Korban. Yom Kippur, the Gemara in Yuma actually gives you a breakdown of the different methods of achieving atonement, and Yom Kippur is its own creature. It doesn't operate the way Korban does.
All right. So if it's an accidental sin,
yeah.
If somebody tells us afterwards, if we made it by accident,
yeah.
How do we make it?
Right, so maybe by being informed afterwards, that can be. Yeah, I eat something and then someone says to me, you know, what you ate wasn't kosher. So that's a case of accidental sin. A person said, you know, they bowed to something, and oops, that was an idol. I don't know. It's very hard to conjure up an image of accidental idolatry. Really? Well, that's good. That means they copied us well. Sorry?
If you weren't aware of the prohibition against idolatry. anyone can imagine that that might have been the case.
Yeah, so the Gemara actually discusses how one could violate idolatry accidentally. There's even a concept of what's called Omer Mutar, somebody who thinks that it's permitted. There's a lot of discussion about it. But the bottom line is that the Gemara says they're worshiping idols intentionally, knowing full well that we don't like that. In the end of the first temple period. So how are you bringing offerings, you know, even having said that the community never dies and therefore it's an ongoing, nonetheless, you can't get around the fact that the, that this is intentional. So the Gemara's answer is, Horas Sha'a Kaya. The answer is, this was special dispensation. It was a special ruling for that moment in time that they would bring these offerings to atone. How did you get the special dispensation? So my gut would have been to say, well, Ezra's a Navi, he's a prophet, he's talking to God, and God said to him, this is what you should do. The Nativ, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, disagrees, and says, no, there's a verse, which I didn't bring here, because it would take us farther and farther away from Ezra. But for those who want to look it up, it's a pasuk in Bamidbar, it's chapter 15, sentence 25, and he believes that you could actually deduce from that verse this lesson about bringing an offering to atone for communal idolatry. But I think that it's worth pausing for a minute to think about the image here and the symbolism here of Ezra now arriving and seeking to atone for the sins of the past. Right? We've talked a lot about this issue of how the people in the Second Temple view themselves. Yeah, their whole legitimacy being in question because they don't have all the status and they don't have all the miracles and they're under siege and so forth. And we talked about it in terms of their Pesach exceeding the Pesach of Chizkiyahu and how wonderful it was that they could actually achieve something. But generally speaking, they model everything they do on the past. Here comes Ezra from Babel. And he says, you know, those people before had some mistakes on their record. Mistakes, intentional, whatever. And we are going to make up for that. We are going to do right where they did wrong. I think that's it's a remarkable image when you think about it. Yeah, to apply it today, right? Since we're coming up on Yom Yerushalayim tonight, hark back to Yom HaAtzmaut, and if you were to think about somebody, you know, at the time of the establishment of the state or the reunification of Yerushalayim, saying, you know, in the times of the Beis Hamikdash, in the times of the Temple, they did this wrong. We're going to do this right now. You know, it's a very powerful statement. They might be accused of hubris. But that's what Ezra's doing. I mean, he has 70 years instead of a couple of thousand. I think it is, yes. I think it is. But actually, bless you, I don't know if it works in his favor. I don't know if the difference is in his favor. Meaning, it means that he has survivors from that original time who are there. And he's saying, yeah, you guys did it wrong. And now we're going to make up for your mistakes.
His teacher.
Well, his teacher's dead. Right? He leaves, according to that Gemara, he leaves after Baruch is gone. But it's to me, this is a very interesting idea that Ezra does this. I don't think it's something to just sort of read and move on. Shana.
Well, on Yom Kippur, we say,
yeah, that's a problem. That always bothers me. Doesn't it bother you? You're right. Shana points out that on Yom Kippur, we say in the Vidui, right? But we and our ancestors have sinned. Like my ancestors are looking down and saying, thanks a lot. Yeah.
But with this explanation, I mean, we are following the assumption that this was the reason for this chatat. And we brought it this, we don't know.
No, but that's the point. In other words, whenever we read anything in Tanakh, and then we look at what the Parshan or the Gemara or the Midrash, whatever, is saying, our question is always, so what does the Parshan, what does the Gemara think is happening here? I'm not in the text. But my point is the way that the Gemara is painting this view, Rambam has an entirely different view. Rambam says that these offerings aren't about sin. They're celebration of the dedication of the temple, which, by the way, happened before Ezra ever showed up. Rambam doesn't take the Gemara's view. But I think that I think that you have to ask yourself, what does the Gemara think is happening here? Elisheva and then David.
But if the first Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, is there a general acknowledgement that there were some sins and that he's making up? It's not like, oh, I wonder where this came from.
Yeah.
Like, So it's not that there is anything hidden.
Right.
It's pretty...
Oh, right. No, absolutely. This is not an invention. Remember, when we mentioned this also, I think, last week, when Tatanai, the governor, right, showed up and said, hey, what are you doing here building and all that, we gave him our whole history. And we said, and God punished us because we had done this wrong, and now we're, you know... The fact that they're aware of it is one thing, but I think the idea that, and now we're going to atone for them, I just think it's a fascinating additional step. David?
So the Rambam's point of view hint at the fact that Ezra might not have felt the dedication was done properly the first time?
I don't know. That's a good question. Right? I've been bothered, as I keep stating, by the fact that the dedication should have happened before Ezra ever showed up, and it did happen. We read about it. So what are you doing bringing Miluim, dedicating it? Is it that Ezra feels like it wasn't done right? The air wasn't good. I moved to town, and now I need to set up a new one. Not that it ever happens in any city. Is that really what's happening? I don't know. Yes?
Doesn't it bother you theologically that one person could atone for someone else's sins?
I think that's a bedrock idea within Judaism. That when it comes to community, we are considered one. We're not considered different people. We have the idea of both vicarious atonement and collateral damage. Right? We have the idea that if an individual is part of a family, you may not like it, but if an individual is part of a family, if an individual is part of a community, and they're doing things that are wrong, the individual is held to be a member of the group, and therefore can be responsible for it, but the individual can also create merit for the group and set things straight. I want to stress something, which I should stress, because I think this may be the point that we're getting hung up on. And looking at Debbie, I also think I have to make this point, which is that that there are multiple levels for each person's existence. Meaning, I exist as Mordechai Torchiner. I exist as part of a family. I exist as part of a community. If I do something wrong personally, but you, because you're wonderful, do great things that overshadow the wrong that I did, then my sin may not factor in on the communal level. Because on the communal level, the community is balanced for the good. But I'm still going to have to answer for what I did. Yeah, it doesn't wipe away my personal accounting. No one will ever be able, after their time on earth, to go to God and say, yes, it's true, I stole that. However, somebody else died for my sins. That's not one of ours. That's one of the distinctions. But the community won't suffer because the community has achieved a level of righteousness. That's the idea that I'm getting at, Joyce.
But we do know from the story of Abraham that generations are punished because of what Abraham did.
Potentially, yes, right. What Joyce is referring to is the Gemara in Nedarim that asks the question of, why we went down to Egypt and seems to pin the guilt on Abraham, right? Whether it's because he took Eliezer out the students out to war, or whether it's because he asked, how do I know that I'm going to get the land and so forth. I actually think there's another way to read that Gemara potentially. That it's not asking quite that question, but certainly the way you're presenting it is, I think, the normal way people read that Gemara. And it does suggest that people may suffer, indeed, for what their ancestors did, just as they may benefit. I mean, the Navi talks about this, right? The ancestors ate the unripe figs, and our teeth are going to be the ones that are set on edge, right? Avoseinu achlu boser. What's that? I don't remember the rest of the pasuk. But I don't remember exactly. Those are the two ways to understand, the two basic ways to understand this karban, either miluim or atonement for the idolatry that had been performed. The other question, though, is what's with the 96 and the 77? These are weird numbers. So I have two different approaches. Go back to source number one and the Gemara's approach. We didn't finish the Gemara. After the Gemara says, Haras Shah Haya, it was special dispensation, it then continues to say, Hachi Nami Mistabra, it makes sense to say that it was special dispensation. Dilote Mahachi, because if you're not going to say that, look at the rest of the Pasuk. Elim Tishim Bishishan, 96 rams. Kabasim Shivim Bishiva, 77 sheep. Kenegin me. What was that for? Why 70s? I don't know if they're bothered by the 96 or just the 77, but they're clearly bothered by the 77. And their answer is, Ella Haras Shah Haisa. Yeah, that was also a special ruling for that time that they should have 77. So this too is special dispensation. So the Gemara seems to think that actually there is a meaning to 77 and we just don't know what it is. Whereas Ibn Ezra, right, no stranger to charting his own path, in source number 2, says, Tishim v'shisha, shivim v'shiva, kefiya cholasam, ein lahim tam. He says, yeah, this is what they had. You went to the pantry, this is what you brought out, and that was it. Why are you serving that? Because that's what I had. That's I think a relatively straightforward answer, but I think it is instructive. Someone asked this question last time, at the end. To ask the question of, so why? When you say there was a special dispensation, right? But what's the goal of the dispensation? Special dispensation does not just mean Ezra randomly said, this sounds like a good idea. There has to be some kind of a purpose that is behind it. So presumably the first Haras Shah, the first special dispensation that we're talking about to atone for people who sinned intentionally, right? I think that I understand. You want to clear the slate. You want to say all the guilt of the first temple is now gone, and so you're going to bring an offering, even though that's not technically the way it's supposed to work. The statement is, you need to not be haunted by the ghosts of what happened the first time, and so therefore this is valuable and God is going to accept it. That Haras Shah, that special step, I understand. And Rashi actually seems to say it. If you take a look at source number 3, Rashi says, Haras Shah Haisa, it was a ruling for that time, that even though they had sinned intentionally, this would atone. That's what we're being told. Get rid of the ghosts of the past. I don't know why you would have a Haras Shah special ruling to say and bring 77 animals. I think that requires more knowledge of what was going on at that time. It could have had to do with the number of families. It could have had special meaning for them. But I have not seen anybody who could offer an explanation of significance of why 77. There's another view, Meir Simcha of Divinsk, in his Meshech Chachma, to that same passage in Bamidbar chapter 15, has a whole other view of the Haras Shah, but I didn't want to go further with this. But what we see here is, and now just to summarize what we have for chapter 8, is you get Ezra's very symbol-loaded arrival. Right, arriving in the month of Av, the whole business with Aaron's Yahrzeit. Av is the month when the first temple was destroyed. We have the shortage of the Levium, for whatever reason. We gave a whole bunch of potential reasons, as well as the potential punishment of the Levites for not coming, the loss of the tithes. Ezra refusing the king's help, saying, I've been telling him all about how God helps us and punishes the wicked too. How in the world could I now rely on him for assistance? And then you have this Karban. It's a nation that I think has a very mixed identity of sort of messianic redemption on the one hand and human falling short on the other. And Ezra is here to bolster the messianic side of it, to say, we are going to beat whatever it was that took us down the first time, and we are going to become the nation that we always knew we could become. That's what I see Ezra accomplishing for the people. Clear? Okay. So right now, if we stop here, I always feel like this at different points in Tanakh. If we stop here, everything would be wonderful, right? It's rosy. We build the temple. We dedicate it. Ezra's here. Mashiach, so to speak, has arrived, and they can ride off into the sunset. And then we get chapters 9 and 10.